Hello and welcome to another episode of Mike on MedTech, a show on the MedTech Matters podcast channel. I'm Sean Fetsky, Editor-in-Chief of MPL. Joining me as always is Mike Drews, President of Vascular Sciences. How are you doing today, Mike?
I'm very good, Sean. Thank you for asking.
Great. So I'm going to do a very brief introduction on this one, but in this episode we're, you know, performing a gap analysis on what's missing in our regulatory and quality systems. As I indicated, we've got a lot going on in this one, so I want to get right into it. So, Mike, can you start by, you know, just taking a quick minute to really explain why we're dedicating an episode to things that are missing from regulatory and quality systems?
Yeah, great question, Sean. And as always, thanks for the opportunity to talk to you and your audience about this. And as we begin this new year of 2022, one of the many things I've been thinking about lately is there's a lot of people that are talking, sometimes even complaining about our current regulatory system, what it does, how it works. But there's really not a lot of serious discussions going on offering practical, tangible advice, tangible ideas on how to actually improve it, to fill in the gaps, so to speak. That's why I call it sort of a gap analysis. And there's really, Sean, two perspectives that I'd like to take to kind of drive this conversation. One is to try to make it as practical as we can for all of our friends in the audience who work in industry. In other words, in spite of the limitations that you and I talk about today, what can manufacturers do right now today to mitigate or overcome them, you know, to avoid problems? Because right. One of my philosophies, Sean, is, and we've talked about this before, is I refuse to use regulation or FDA as an excuse to hold us back. I think there's way too much of that going on in our industry. And then the other reason why I thought it would be good to have this conversation is because we do have some folks I know who listen to our discussions who work in regulatory agencies, whether it's the FDA here in the U.S. or other parts of the world. I have a number of my friends in regulatory agencies who have told me that they listen to our discussions, although I'm sure they would never admit to that publicly. But, you know, I would encourage those who work in regulatory agencies, if you hear a suggestion or an idea that you think has some merit, please bring it up in your office and have some discussion. And if necessary, reach out to people like Sean or myself, because I truly want to, maybe this is a little naive thinking, Sean, but I truly want to make the world, or at least our portion of it, the medical device industry, a better place. So that's kind of why I thought it would be good to have this discussion today, Sean, on what's missing in our regulatory system, a gap analysis, if you will.
Fantastic. And I think that perfectly sets the stage on why we're doing it. And now let's get right into the list of, you know, what items have been identified as missing or possibly needed. So first we're going to focus in on communicating with the FDA. So Mike, in your opinion, do we need a wellness device registration, a wellness pre-sub, and or a wellness device database? Obviously looking at wellness products that we are classifying as separate from medical devices.
Yeah, great question, Sean. And under the general topic of communication, and specifically mechanism of communication with the FDA, we have several mechanisms already, most notably is the pre-submission meeting or the pre-sub, but I think we need some additional mechanisms, and one of them is under the topic of the wellness device. You and I have talked about this before, Sean, but for the benefit of our audience, a wellness device is it's a medical device, but it's not a regulated medical device. A regulated medical device is something that fits the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations definition of a medical device. And in essence, what that is something, anything, quite frankly, other than a drug that prevents, diagnoses, or treats a disease, injury, or condition. So the definition of a medical device in the CFR is many, many paragraphs long, but if you boil it down to its essence, it's something, anything other than a drug that prevents, diagnoses or treats a disease, injury, or condition. So if your device prevents, diagnoses, or treats a disease, injury, or condition, it's probably, underline probably, a regulated medical device. How it's regulated by FDA, that's a topic of a different discussion. But alternatively, if it doesn't prevent, diagnose, or treat a disease, injury, or condition, then it's probably a wellness device. Wellness devices, as you know, Sean, are becoming much more popular today. Probably the best example is the Fitbit. But unfortunately, Sean, and I do a lot of work in this area, there is no way, certainly no formal mechanism in place where a company can prophylactically take their device to the FDA and say, here's our device, this is what it does, this is how it works, for all of the following reasons. We think it is a wellness device that does not require any oversight by the FDA. Do you agree with us? Yes or no? Unfortunately, right. Sean, and I've made this suggestion to FDA many, many times, there is no mechanism, certainly not to do that directly. There are some indirect ways to do it, but in my opinion, Sean, we really need a direct mechanism to do that, because as a result, what's happened sometimes is some companies do put devices on the market under what they think is a wellness device exemption, but FDA doesn't see it that way. And then, of course, as you can imagine, FDA comes knocking on your door and they say, hey, you seem to be advertising a medical device here. We don't remember you ever coming and talking to us about what the heck is going on. So we really need a mechanism to avoid that. And also under the general wellness device category, I think that, you know, creating a pre-sub to do that, I think, would be a great idea, although it is a little bit of an oxymoron to have a pre-sub meeting for a wellness device, because a pre-sub is a pre-submission meeting. The underlying assumption there is it's a meeting that happens before the submission. A wellness device, there is no submission, so how do you have a pre-submission meeting without any submission? But nonetheless, you know, that's just a matter of semantics. And then the final suggestion under the wellness device category, Sean, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this, is there's no way to sort of find out if you're coming up with what you think is a wellness device, if there's other devices on the market that are similar to it that are also wellness devices. In other words, there is no wellness device database like there is for, there's a 510K database and a De Novo database and a PMA database and an HDE database. In fact, CDRH has about 18 different databases, but there is no wellness device database. And so it might be an interesting conversation to talk about how we could have a wellness device database. Yes, it would be a little bit of a challenge to implement, because a true wellness device requires absolutely nothing from the FDA, no approval, no clearance, no registration, no QMS, no design controls, no nothing. So how would you sort of force companies to register or list their device in this wellness device database? That's a solvable problem, but coming up with some sort of a mechanism to make it easier for people to prevent problems, and that's what I'm about here, Sean, as a regulatory consultant, trying to prevent problems from before they happen. I think some sort of a wellness device database, along with some sort of a mechanism for taking your wellness device to the FDA to confirm that they see it as a wellness device, I think those are all, in my opinion, Sean, reasonable suggestions. What do you think?
Well, I think the and I'm gonna go ahead and say it's a wellness evaluation meeting rather than a pre-sub, because as you indicated, there would be no submission. So I think a wellness evaluation meeting, and however they want to abbreviate that to make it a little more catchy. I think you address the issues of the wellness device database, where there's, you know, at least the FDA would not have the authority. So, whether or not that's just in the best interest of the wellness industry, I guess that's a matter of opinion. But, creating that database certainly would be, almost like a substantial equivalence with wellness products. So I'm gonna jump to the next one, and it's a phrase that you've definitely said before for those who have listened to other podcasts, and that's having a catch-up 510K and letter to file pre-sub, a meeting with the FDA, please correct me if I'm wrong, that will allow a company to basically update the agency on perhaps multiple updates that they've put into place through a letter to file that, if looked at all at once, appear like it was a significant change that would require a separate 510K submission. Am I describing that accurately?
You're exactly spot on correct, Sean. And let me, for the benefit of our audience, add a little bit of color to that. So one of the most common reasons why companies get 43 observations and sometimes even warning letters from the FDA is under the general area of change management. In other words, they have a device on the market, they make a change to that device, they deem that change to be a relatively minor change. In other words, they don't have to notify the FDA either in the form of a special 510K or a PMA supplement. Instead, they handle it as what we call a letter to file. And then FDA finds out about that change and they say, gee, we don't know what you all were smoking. You must be smoking your socks because we don't see that as an insignificant change. You should have notified us, so on and so on. So this is a pretty common reason why, in fact, companies get in trouble with the FDA. And along those lines, Sean, a related problem is what I call change creep. So you're familiar with our discussions in the past of the 510K predicate creep. Well, change creep is very similar. In other words, a device company has a device on the market, they make a change to it, they don't notify it at FDA, they handle it via a letter to file. A little bit further down the road, they make another change to the product. Once again, they don't notify FDA, they handle it as a letter to file. Again, further down the road, they make a third change to the device. They don't notify FDA. So you see where I'm going with this, Sean. Each of these changes, right, when you consider them incrementally, in other words, by themselves, it might be deemed as a non-significant change, a change that can legitimately be handled as a letter to file. However, when you start to add all of these changes up together, those insignificant changes now start to become more significant. Unfortunately, Sean, there's no way, certainly no formal mechanism, where we can take that change or those series of changes and vet it with the FDA to make sure, you know, that they see it as an insignificant change as well. A number of people, and myself included, use this phrase, a catch-up 510K, and I don't mean catch-up in the ketchup and mustard, you know, hot dog sense of the word. I mean, you know, catch-up in terms of, you know, retrospective sense of the word, but there is no formal type of 510K that we call a catch-up 510K. I find it fascinating, Sean, that we're now in the year 2022 and we still don't have this. We've been talking about this for years, but we still don't have it.
Right.
Now, as I said at the beginning, Sean, I refuse to let regulation hold me back, using it as an excuse, you know, to say, well, there is no catch-up 510K, so we just can't, you know, do anything here. On the contrary, my advice to companies, and I do this all the time, is take a legitimate change. If you're going to make a change to your device anyway, maybe that would justify a special 510K, or perhaps, you know, maybe you're in the gray area, but put it into a special 510K anyway, and then along with it, kind of roll into it or include all of the previous changes that you've made to your device anyway. And then when you walk into the door at FDA, and I would do this as a pre-sub, I would say, oh, by the way, as a matter of professional courtesy, while we're telling you about this most important, this most significant change, we also want to use this as an opportunity to update you on the previous changes that we've made to the device, which, oh, by the way, we have not notified you of because they were not significant and we handled that as a letter to file or letter to files, and here are all the reasons why. Once mm-hmm. again, we do not have a formal submission, a catch-up 510K, if you will, nor do we have a formal type of pre-sub. And again, it's kind of an oxymoron to call it a pre-sub because the letter to file is for a device already on the market. So this is post-sub, if you will. So maybe this would be a post-submission meeting. I don't know, but we can call it whatever the heck we want. You know, Shakespeare said a rose right. The name still smells of sweet. But the point is, we need a mechanism in place where companies can come to the FDA prophylactically to present these things, to do these things before doing them unilaterally and then, you know, getting that knock on your door, hey, you know, there seems to be a problem here. Once again, Sean, and I'm biased because these are my suggestions, but I don't think there's anything that we're talking about here that's unreasonable. Do you?
No, absolutely not. In fact, with this one, you're taking something that you can get in trouble for, yet there is no proactive, or I should say there's no, you certainly provided an alternative way of avoiding any problems. But really, there's no proactive set way in place to avoid being in, running into problems with the agency over these collective changes, yet you can get dinged for it. So the fact that it's like, you know, it has the penalty on one end, but there's no recourse in place specifically to address that penalty is problematic in my eyes. So I think you're dead on with that being a definitely one that's necessary.
Exactly correct, Sean. And I love the fact that you're using the word proactive, because that's really what most of all of this comes down to. Do we want to be proactive or reactive?
Right.
When you look at, you know, regulation across the board, Sean, most regulation is created retrospectively or reactively. In other words, there's a problem that occurs, and therefore we create new regulation to try to prevent that problem from happening again in the future, which is certainly an admirable goal. But I think the emphasis should be here on proactive, on preventing problems from occurring, as opposed to reacting to them once they do occur. My perfect example, Sean, from the quality side of the world, and I think we may have mentioned this in some of our previous discussions, is a CAPA, a corrective action, preventative action. This is something that and everybody in our industry knows about. But here's my question. Why the heck do we call it a CAPA? I think, you know, this is quite frankly back-ass words. We should call it a PACA, a preventive action, corrective action, because the emphasis should be on prevention, not correction. That's, you know, what we're talking about in some of the ideas here today, is preventing problems from occurring as opposed to correcting them once they've already occurred.
Right. Absolutely. All right. So the next one we have is, again, we use the word pre-sub as just indicating that kind of format for what it would look like. But a pre-sub for manufacturing issues or to resolve 483s and or warning letters, you know, with the agency. What are your thoughts there about, you know, establishing some sort of meeting with the agency to address those types of issues?
Yeah, again, great question, Sean. Companies can get 483 observations and in some cases warning letters from FDA for lots of different reasons. And when they do, they're supposed to implement changes, implement corrective actions to correct the problems or prevent the problems from happening in the future. But unfortunately, in most cases, there is no way to formally take your proposed preventative action, if you will, to the agency and vet it with them. In other words, a pre-sub, if you will, but again, this is going to be a post-sub when you think about it, but whatever you call it, doesn't matter. Some sort of a mechanism where we can go as a company to the FDA and say, okay, here's the problem that you found in the last inspection, and here is what we're doing to address it or fix it or prevent it or what have you. Do you agree that this is a reasonable solution, yada, yada, yada? FDA did start a pilot program kind of to allow companies to do this about a year or so ago, but it really hasn't gone anywhere. And so just simply, and quite frankly, I don't think we need a new program. I don't think we need a pilot program to do this. We've already got the general mechanism of the pre-sub process in place. How much effort would it take to simply create another subtype of pre-sub? Right now we've got about 6 or 7 subtypes of pre-subs within CDRH already, and on the drug side of the world there's even more. But how much effort would it take to create a subtype of a pre-sub for manufacturing issues, for the catch-up 510K letter to file that we talked about, for the wellness device mm-hmm. that we talked about. All we're talking about is just creating a few more types of pre-subs, or if you don't like the phrase pre-sub, fine, we'll change it to something else. I don't care. But some mechanism in place that would allow companies to be much more proactive in preventing problems, Sean. Once again, maybe I'm naive. Maybe I fell off the turnip truck yesterday, but I don't think there's anything that I'm suggesting here that's unreasonable or overly burdensome. In fact, I think it would be a win-win for both industry as well as the FDA.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree that, you know, if we're able to eliminate these problems, you know, as quickly and as effectively as possible, it's going to save time across the board. You know, you're not going to run into, you know, issues where these continually, you know, continue to spring up and leading to greater regulatory issues and, you know, just problems with the agency, with companies that task, you know, both sides with additional work. So,
remember the adage, Sean, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Right. So we're talking about, you know, spending a little bit of effort in prevention as opposed to a whole bunch of time and money on cures.
Exactly. So let's move over to the regulatory pathway. You know, we're talking about, you know, 510K, PMA, de novo. So with that in mind, Mike, you know, share with us your thoughts on whether or not a pathway should be created that provides a de novo type or a de novo like version of the PMA. I mean, maybe you could explain what that might look like, and then whether you think it's necessary.
Yeah, great question, Sean. And once again, this is something that's bothered me for many years, not just as a regulatory consultant, but more importantly, as a professional biomedical engineer. And here's what I mean by this. So in the class 3 universe, most class 3 devices are brought onto market as a PMA, sometimes an HDE, but most likely as a PMA. We've talked about this before, Sean. But why is it that all PMA devices or class 3 devices are treated equally? To me, that makes absolutely no sense. When you think about it, in the class 2 universe, for example, not all class 2 devices are treated equally. Devices that are essentially me too devices, in other words, devices that are very similar to a device that's already on the market, what we call a predicate device that uses well-established technology and the risks and benefits are understood and so on. Those devices are brought onto the market. Typically, it's a 510K, which require mm-hmm. a much less rigorous review of the submission by the FDA, as well as much less testing by the company. That's why, in fact, most medical device companies prefer a 510K. On the other hand, other class 2 devices that are not Me Too's, that are new or novel, that might use a new mechanism of action, or they might be going after a different indication that was never pursued before. Those do have, in general, more extensive requirements for testing. Those do require typically a longer, more extensive review by the agency. And to me, Sean, by the way, that's not because of regulatory reasons. That's because of common sense. Right? It's common sense. So if we do that in the class 2 universe, why can't or why shouldn't we apply the same regulatory logic, if you will, to the class 3, to the PMA universe? What I mean by that is, let me just use one of my many favorite examples, bare metal coronary stents. There are dozens and dozens of bare metal coronary stents on the market today. Yes, there are some subtle differences in the design. Some are made out of a solid hypotube. Some are knitted by a piece of wire. Some have different shapes of the wire or the tube or what have you. But at the end of the day, the mechanism of action, if you will, is exactly the same. They all work exactly the same way. And so does it make sense if a company is bringing a bare metal coronary stent today, if they're bringing that to the market, does that warrant as an extensive review by the agency as the very first company that made a bare metal coronary stent and brought it onto the market. In other words, why don't we have a 510K-like version of the PMA for Class 3 devices, but for devices that are Class 3 that are Me Too kinds of devices? And let's face it, John, even in the Class 3 universe, we have a ton of Me Too devices. On the other hand, for those small number of devices that are Class 3s, that are PMAs, that are truly novel, that are not similar to what we already have, those would have a de novo-like PMA. And I think there's a tremendous number of potential advantages to this kind of a model, Sean. One is, from a company perspective, it's going to be much, much more efficient because they're going to have have a much better understanding of what's going to be required if they're doing a Me Too PMA as opposed to a de novo like PMA. And from the FDA's perspective, it's going to make the whole review process much more efficient, much hopefully less time and money, even though, yeah, it still is a Class 3 device, no question about it. But it's going to be give them more resources to devote because to me, Sean, it's common sense. A de novo-like PMA should have a more rigorous, more extensive review than a 510K-like PMA. Does that make sense, Sean?
Right.
In the PMA universe, in the Class 3 universe, we don't have a concept of substantial equivalence. But even in the PMA Class 3 universe, I use the concept, I use the regulatory logic of substantial equivalence all the time. In other words, not in the regulatory sense, because you can't argue that my Class 3 device is substantially equivalent to a predicate in the regulatory sense, but I use the concept of substantial equivalence in the engineering sense all the time. And specifically, what I mean by that is in terms of the testing for the device and the risk for the device. Simply put, if my Class 3 device is similar to another device, it makes sense that from a testing perspective, we can use some of those tests that were used for the other device on my device. And from a risk perspective, if the technology is similar, it stands to reason that some of the risks might be similar in the other device. And so I will incorporate those risks into my risk mitigation strategy for my device. So simply put, Sean, I use substantial equivalence in the engineering sense in the Class 3 universe all the time, even though probably every regulatory consultant and certainly every regulatory textbook would say that in the Class 3 universe, there is no concept of substantial equivalence. I strongly disagree. It doesn't exist in the regulatory sense, but it certainly exists in the engineering sense. So at the end of the day, Sean, and again, I'm biased because this is my idea, but I like the idea of having a 510K-like PMA and having a de novo-like PMA. What do you think?
I mean, you know, really it just comes down to safety. So long as there's a way to ensure that, you know, the product that would, you know, is currently requires a PMA can be evaluated, you know, using substantial equivalence. You know, maybe it's my lack of experience in, you know, working directly with, you know, regulatory submissions and products and, you know, evaluating safety and things. But when you start talking about an implant or, you know, your example, the bare metal stent, I get a little, you know, I don't want to say, you know, I know this isn't what you're indicating, but I'm okay with it being, challenge isn't the right word, but I don't want it to be an easy process for a company to get an implanted device through the agency. I understand you want to eliminate unnecessary hurdles, and as so long as there's a safe way to do that, an effective way to do that, then I'm all for it. But I want to make sure that, you know, would be, and I think that's why you're different. You're not just saying, should we have a 510K, you know, for PMA with substantial equivalence or, you know, a de novo, the same exact footprint. You know, you're indicating that it would be a different pathway. So that right there indicates that it's not what we have in place currently. This would be an additional item. So, you know, so as long as that safety is there, as long as that, you know, the threat of a problem is reduced as you know, as much as possible.
Well, fair point, Sean. And let me be crystal clear. I don't want to give you or our audience an impression that I'm advocating taking shortcuts or not doing certain testing that I think as a biomedical engineering we need to do. On the contrary, as you know, Sean, mm-hmm. I often recommend to companies to do certain tests of medical devices, even though it might not be required by the FDA, because as you and I have talked about before, when a company gets a 510K, when they get a de novo or a PMA, when they get ISO certified or a CE mark, that's the academic equivalent of being a C student. That just means that you're passing. So I'm not advocating taking shortcuts. But what I am advocating right. is doing what makes sense. And when I say doing what makes sense, not from necessarily a regulatory perspective, because let's be honest, Sean, I read regulation every day that to me makes absolutely no sense, but doing what makes sense from a biomedical engineering perspective, from a medicine and a biology perspective. And to me, if you have a device, class 3 or any other device, that's very similar to other devices like it already on the market, then you should be able to beg, borrow, and steal, so to speak, from those other devices. You shouldn't have to recreate the wheel, so to speak. On the other hand, if you have a device that's totally different, that's not similar to another device, then that's when you have to be more rigorous. And just one other small but important point that I would make, Sean, and then we can move on. You mentioned implants. Well, let's just remember that there are a lot of devices that are permanent implants that are not, in fact, Class 3 PMA devices. In fact, the orthopedic right. world is loaded with lots and lots of orthopedic implants, permanent implants that are not Class 3, that are Class 2. And, you know, for no other reason than historical reasons. They were on the market prior to 1976 when FDA started regulating medical devices and they were grandfathered in. So just because something is an implant doesn't necessarily mean that it's class 3. Alternatively, just because something is non-invasive doesn't necessarily mean that it's low risk. I see lots of people, especially working in the area of software, they say, one of my customers just said this to me yesterday. Oh, my device is just a piece of software. You know, it can't possibly be high risk. Well, on the contrary, there are some devices, in vitro diagnostics for cancer, for example, that are totally non-invasive, and yet they're class 3, they're PMAs, because if that IVD is used for cancer, then, you know, the probability of false positives and false negatives can be a very high risk. And the last thing right. that I'll just mention quickly, Sean, and then we can continue on, there is precedent for this idea of not treating all class 3 devices equally, you know, having a 510K-like PMA versus having a de novo-like PMA. And the precedent that I would point to is nowadays with COVID, you and I have talked about the emergency use authorization. Well, suffice it to say, not all EUA devices are treated equally. The vast majority of EUAs that have come through the FDA today are what I call a 510K or Me Too EUAs. That is, devices that are already in the market prior to COVID, and the company just went back to the FDA under the EUA and added a COVID indication. In those cases, Sean, it is a much quicker, much less rigorous review of that product for the EUA as opposed to a very, very small number of devices, and I really mean small here, that mm-hmm. companies have tried to get EUAs on where that device was not on the market before. And as a result, it's a much, much more rigorous review. Much, much more data is included. I have a customer right now who's trying to get an EUA on a totally new diagnostic, and it's not an immunodiagnostic. It's not a molecular diagnostic. It relies on a totally different mechanism of action. And because of that, FDA is setting the bar much higher in terms of regulatory burden, in terms of
of data, you know, just to show that the mechanism of action is legitimate and so on. And quite frankly, Sean, the company is really having a hard time swallowing that pill in spite of me trying to tell them, hey, this is not a Me Too or a 510K EUA. This is a de novo-like EUA, and therefore the burden is going to be much higher. So to me, Sean, you know, everything that we're talking about here, just like, you know, pretty much everything that we talk about in all of our conversations, to me, this is just common sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's and we're dancing around, you know, my next the next point, and that is the idea of having substantial equivalence in class three, and you know, with the PMA realm. I mean, that's, you know, we've already kind of touched on this a bit, but you know, what do you have to say on that?
Yeah, like I said, Sean, according to most regulatory professionals and most regulatory textbooks, there is no concept of substantial equivalence in the Class 3 universe. I strongly disagree. As I said before, I use the concept, the regulatory logic of substantial equivalence for Class 3 devices, PMA devices, all the time, but not in the regulatory sense, rather in the engineering and the biological sense. And the two most common areas that I do this are in the area of testing as well as in risk mitigation. So this is why, as I've said in some of our other discussions, Sean, you know, we've already got thousands and thousands of pages of regulation. We don't really need more regulation. And it might sound like, you know, gee, this guy's a regulatory consultant, and yet he's saying that we don't need more regulation. You know, what the heck is going on there? Well, I genuinely believe that we don't need more regulation. In fact, what we do need is more people understanding the regulation that we do have, not the necessarily the letter of the law, so to speak, but the spirit of the law, or what I call the regulatory logic, to be able to apply it in many different ways. The concept, the regulatory logic of substantial equivalence is not so much a regulatory concept as it is a biomedical engineering concept. And when you think about it and when you understand it in those terms, I think the possibilities to use it are almost endless.
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to agree with the general idea of your statement. You know, like I said, so long as there's nothing being sacrificed along the way, which you clearly, you know, you made clear that that's not the point. It's more about just doing what makes sense, and not you know, not just following the regulation to follow the regulation, but rather what makes sense and what's most effective, which is certainly fair. So unfortunately, we are coming up on the end of this episode, but as I often do, you know, Mike, we covered a lot in a very short period of time. Can you give us, you know, besides I think the general theme is take a proactive approach as much as you can with all of these items, even though they're not in place, as a medical device manufacturer, take a proactive approach as best you can. But what takeaways do you have that you'd like to share, you know, based around the items that we did cover today?
Yeah, great question, Sean. And thanks for the opportunity to kind of wrap this up and share some final thoughts here. So as you just pointed out, we went through a number of possible suggestions. It's definitely not a comprehensive list. There are certainly many more suggestions that I could come up with, that I'm sure you could come up with, or other people could come up with. So I think we as an industry, we need to continue these, to have these conversation of what works and what doesn't work, and for those things that don't work, or for those things that we talked about today that are missing, how can we fix them? How can we fill in those gaps, so to speak? For our friends in the audience who are working on the industry side, please remember to, as Sean said, you know, be proactive as opposed to reactive, and don't use regulation as an excuse to hold us back. Quite frankly, I think there's way too much of this blame game going on, you know, companies and people in them saying, well, we would like to do this, but we can't do it because FDA is making it too difficult, or the regulatory mechanism doesn't exist to allow us to bring this to the FDA. I'm sorry, but quite frankly, that's just, you know, not a good excuse. We've got to be able to come up with solutions. You know, as an engineer myself, Sean, you know, engineering is all about problem solving. So whether you're talking about solving a problem by designing a physical widget or solving a problem by figuring out how to have a discussion with the FDA, quite frankly, I don't care less. The problem-solving skills are exactly the same. So given the regulatory environment and the regulatory mechanisms and the limitations thereof, we need to be able to come up with ways, usually creative ways, to address these problems in the short term. And then in the longer term, you know, to come up with ways to, you know, come up with better solutions instead of coming up with, you know, kludgy solutions or Band-Aid fixes, which might be okay for right now. In the future, we need a solution that really addresses the root cause of the problem. So that's all on the industry side. And then finally, to my friends that work in FDA and in other, you know, similar organizations around the world. And yes, in fact, I do know that many of you listen to these conversations, even though I'm sure you, most of you would never admit to that publicly. But I know that some of you are listening. Please take some of these suggestions in mind and, you know, try to appreciate, you know, what it's like from the industry perspective and, you know, working together. You know, please feel free to reach out to Sean or myself or others in this industry because, you know, we would be happy to have conversations. I know there's a lot of politicians out there that say, oh, yeah, you know, FDA wants to, you know, encourage companies to come and talk to them, yada, yada, yada. And I don't mean to be cynical, Sean, but I think it's very easy for politicians to say those things. But in reality, I see very, very little of that actually happening in the real world, certainly in the day-to-day trenches, which is where I spend most of my time working. So those are just a few of my final thoughts, Sean. What do you think I missed? What do you think is the most important for our audience to remember? And then we can wrap this up.
Yeah, well, again, I would just say I think the most important is that proactive approach because, you know, as you said, you know, the approval or clearance is a C grade. So, you know, you get a C, you may not have to worry about the FDA, but at a C, you may still need to deal with a lawyer who's suing your company because of a product liability situation or something like that. So it's always best to ensure that you're doing, you know, what you would want done were that device or, you know, being used on a family member or, you know, your grandmother. You know, so it's always great to keep in mind, you know, are we doing what needs to be done from a, you know, patient safety, from a product effectiveness, and you know, quite frankly, I mean, it's a business. Are we doing what we need to do in order to ensure we're not going to, you know, get our butts sued off and go out of business? You know, heaven forbid someone dies or something like that. So with all of these are great suggestions for different ideas. And as Mike indicated, certainly not a comprehensive list. So I encourage you, you know, if you have other ideas, whether you're an FDA listener or you're a, you know, a device manufacturer or a supplier, if you have other ideas, please send them my way and we'll put them together and do a part two or, you know, even a part three if we get enough. But until next time, you know, unfortunately that is all the time we have. So until next time, I'd like to thank Mike, as always, for providing his insights and expertise, President of Vascular Sciences. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. So until next time, this has been Sean Fenske, Editor-in-Chief of MPO, saying thanks for listening.